We should be going. The cheering section. Okay. We are there. Okay. Hey, yeah. Posting all kinds of stuff. Little competition. Yeah, he might just be a little sore. Huh. All right. Well, we'll get started here. Reminder to everybody about our Holy Week coming up next week, starting Sunday night all the way through the following Sunday. For those listening online, this is Romans part 10. Romans part 10. And it's, amen. He's an amener. Because I've had some of these thoughts on my mind for a little while. And then, you know, when you get into these things, it just seems like it makes sense, some of the things that we've been taught our whole life. And then when you see it in this bigger picture, you begin to understand the whole, this whole letter, this the reason why he's writing and what is going on and all of this stuff. And if you remember last week, Paul, we saw Paul creating this extended kind of compound quote, and he, remember, he's pulling parts of these verses out of Psalm 5 and Psalm 14 and Isaiah and all of this stuff. And his basic argument here was, when the scriptures say things like no one is righteous, no one understands, no one seeks God, no one does good, no one fears the Lord, what he really means is no one. I mean, that was the bottom line, no one. And there's a reason he said that. So, you know, you can't get away with saying that all of those critiques apply to somebody else and not me. You know, the them and not us mindset. And we have to keep in mind here that Paul, before he encounters Jesus, he was a Pharisee. So he came from one of those ruling religious classes in Judaism at that time, and within that tradition, that's where he was. So all of those scriptures that Paul would have quoted, that he did, they, all the Jews, would have understood them as referencing the them, the everybody who wasn't a Gentile. You know, the them. Now, the Pharisees knew all of these passages. And remember, you know, the Jews, they knew this stuff, but they just didn't apply them to themselves. When they read, you know, the Psalms and all of that, they would say, they're the ones who do bad. They're the ones, not us. It's them. So, Paul says, basically here, guys, that isn't going to work anymore. Because whatever God is, however we understand God, all of that now needs to be reinterpreted in the light of Jesus. And because of Jesus, and now we're all on the same ground, all with the same access to God. You know, I heard that, you know, again today, you know, you get some comments on some of your stuff. And, you know, it's God has his special people. And then he has other people he don't like, and he's blinded them, and he's did all of this other stuff. Well, you know, I can understand. I used to wonder that. Well, guys, that's how the Hebrews thought. Were God's special people? They're not. So all of these scriptures are talking about them and not us. You remember Paul is talking in Romans 1 and 14. He said he was a debtor, or he was obligated both to the Greeks and the barbarians. Because the Jews thought that way, but then the Greeks thought that way too. Because they thought, well, we're the civilized class, and the rest of those people are barbarians. They're outsiders. They're on the fringe. They're not like us. So Paul says, you know, we got a problem here with the Jews, and we got a problem with the Greeks here, because everybody thinks everybody else is outsiders. That Greek word for barbarians was barbaro, and guys, I don't know. Maybe you've done this before. But you go into a restaurant, a foreign restaurant, maybe a Mexican restaurant or a Chinese restaurant, and they take your order. They don't speak really good English, and they turn around, and we would say they babble to the other people in a language we don't understand, and we think, hey, they're in our country. They need to speak like us. So we automatically think less. You know what I mean? We have this mindset. They're less than us. So they called all of those who didn't have the Greek culture barbarians. Well, it's the same thing the Jews did. Everybody else is a dog. They don't have our culture. Well, we the same mindset kind of today. We're Americans. We're the cream of the crop. Everybody else is less than us. And Paul said, look, because of Jesus, we all are on the same level, and we all have the same access to God. That's an important Paul. Says, and you remember Paul, when he says I'm obligated, you remember how he starts off in Romans 1, I'm a slave of Christ and an apostle, you know. And that word really means that kind of derogatory word. I'm both a slave and an ambassador. Therefore, I'm obligated equally to you all. Also, the people that you think is beneath you, I'm obligated to them. So Paul, what we've seen so far here is Paul has already gone after the high-mindedness of the Greco-Roman culture in chapter 1. And now he's going after the high-mindedness of his own culture in chapter 3. Again, for Paul, Jesus has put everybody on level ground before God. Now, yes, we saw that the Jews did have an advantage, remember? I mean, that was clear. He said, yes, they were given the law, the scriptures, the oracles of God to guide them. And yes, this was a huge bonus. I mean, thank God that you and I, we grew up in America here where Christianity is prevalent, or used to be anyway, and it's accessible to all of us. We can go to any church we want. We can get 10 churches on the way home, and you know, this is good, and we should be thankful for it. But we also shouldn't suppose that we somehow are better or more direct access to God because of that. Jesus shows us that above all else, the good news is that God is faithful to his creation, and that means every single person. One of the themes in this letter of Romans here is speaking to the Greeks, and you can figure out which category. We're going to be in the Greek category here. He's telling to the Greeks, he's telling you and me, he's telling us who have did this for a long time, he's saying you Greeks need to get over yourself. He's also speaking to the Jews, and he's saying stop thinking that you're better than everybody else. He's saying everybody's flawed, everybody messes up, but God is at work regardless because he is righteous. Now, here's the thing you got to keep in the back of your mind when you read Paul. Because it can seem at some times, and this is kind of the way it's always presented to me when I hear these other people, and honestly, this is the way that I have read this before, but it seems that Paul is incredibly pessimistic, has this pessimistic view of humanity. All terrible, all mess up, all just dirty, rotten worms under the awful gaze of God's righteous indignation. And you know, a lot of people, including myself, have interpreted Paul this way. You know, God is up in the sky. He's looking down on us. He's wagging his head. And you know, nobody's any good. And we're just dirty, rotten, low down. And, you know, he's on the verge of wiping everybody out. And he's tired of it. You know, that's kind of, and you know, a lot of people, they when they read this letter, this is what they come with. But again, this is not really Paul's point here. He's already made the argument in chapter 2 that people who know nothing of God can still actively demonstrate that God is at work in their lives by the way they live. I had the great honor and privilege of talking to a guy today who, I don't know if you would call him a believer. He believes in a creator, but there's a lot of things, and we got to talk for a long, long, long time, and he was just drawn in. You know, I mean, I could see it because everything he has been taught before was the simple thing, you better get right, you know, and you better stay right, or, you know, kind of those things. And he said, I don't understand this, you know. Why would, here's one of the questions, you know, why would God make a devil? If God is created, why would he make a devil? I mean, he said, I just don't get this. You know, I said, see, now we're asking right questions. And so now we can have a conversation here because, you know. So it was really, really good to do those things. And so Paul is not pessimistic here. Paul is actually incredibly optimistic of God's image embedded into humanity here. And all the in all of the surprisingly unexpected places that it can show up. But what Paul has no time for is when we start to say, yeah, but I'm not like them. Yeah, I mean, we're God's special people. They're not. That's when Paul brings out the big guns here. And that's when he uses this most fiery language. And that's one of the ways that Paul is most like Jesus, because we see Jesus over and over again. He shows this amazing grace and peace towards sinners and, you know, just all of this stuff. But you see this frustration and indignation to religious people, to these religious robots. So Paul is in very good company here, because really there are things that should frustrate us and make us angry. And, you know, when you can just come out and say, well, look, I have access to God and you don't. God chose me, you don't. You know what we've done there? We've thrown Christ out the window. We've thrown Christ out the window. It's kind of funny if you guys go on our YouTube, on the Voice of Truth channel, and a comment today was, the cross is just a stick. I thought that was kind of funny. I didn't comment back. I don't comment back, but the cross is just a stick, you know. In other words, you know, you make too much of it. I mean, all of history is bound there. But that's sort of the recap. Now, here we are again, and we got some heavy lifting to do here in Romans because we're getting into these verses here. So I'm going to start in Romans chapter 3. Verse 21. Now, I'm reading today out of the NIV. And I chose it for a specific reason versus the King James. And when we get down to this one verse, you'll see why. Dad done got a buddy. A new buddy. Okay, so verse 21. But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. Now, again, I'm reading this out of the NIV, verse 21. Now, this is a weirdly kind of constructed sentence. But think of it this way. Now, we know that the law wasn't God's righteousness at all. Jesus is God's righteousness. But when we look back, this is what he's saying, but when we look back, we can actually see that all of the scriptures were hinting and pointing and pushing us in the direction of Jesus all along. Paul would say in Galatians, it was a schoolmaster. So it was pulling, pushing, hinting, all of that. We just weren't ready for it. Now, remember last week in verse 20, Paul ended that section by saying, nobody will be declared righteous simply by keeping the rules. Now he's starting the second half of the argument. And I'll tell you as a side note here, this is one of the things that I've really been thinking a lot on this. Because, you know, when you read these verses here, like, the handwriting of ordinances that was against this, he's taken away. And, you know, anytime you mention anything in any church, maybe about law other than Ten Commandments, it's like, oh, no, we don't want any law. We don't want any thing. So, you know, I go back and I look, and Paul is saying, hey, guys, we're free from the law. But that doesn't mean now that you're lawless. And you can do whatever. So I think what we have done, this is just me pondering on these things. Again, I just ponder on these things. Is we come in to the church and we say, hey, we're free from all kinds of structure, all kinds of law, all the laws. We're free from it. We're free from it. And that's the wrong approach. And so now the church, you know, has no structure. They have no boundaries. They have no, you know, so you need that. And God knew they needed it. He gave that to them. But now we're not under it. But Paul is saying that all of that law wasn't there to make us righteous, but it was there pointing and pushing and showing us and hinting of Jesus. We just wasn't ready for that. I was listening to a guy the other day, and he used the reference of cooking. And I thought, man, the way he put this was really good. He says, when you first start cooking, you probably need a cookbook. And this is kind of funny because Tracy's mom is a fantastic cook. She never uses a cookbook. And so Tracy will go and say, well, how do you make this? So you come up with all this language, a pinch of this, a dab of that. It's like, well, no, I need to know how much. Well, I don't know. Just, you know, I just put some in it. You see what I mean? So when you first start cooking, you need the structure. You know, one tablespoon, one teaspoon of this, you know, two cloves of this and all this. But after you become a cook, you're still in the structure. You may go back and look at the cookbook. The cookbook was pointing you somewhere. But now you're not bound by the rules of one tablespoon of salt. And going to hell if you use a tablespoon and a half. You see? So I thought, wow, that's good here. So Paul, you know, he's telling us what this purpose of this law was here. You know, we're going to get to the time when we don't need the cookbook. But you're still going to have to cook. You're still going to have to eat. And generally, like Tracy's mom is a really good cook, and she doesn't go by any instructions, but yet she does. She knows how to make chili beans. And you know what I mean? So that's kind of this ideal here. So in what Paul is saying here to us, you know, about keeping this law, he's saying, you know what, guys, don't worry. It's okay. Because we'll be made righteous through Jesus. That's what he's going to argue, his point here. We're going to be made righteous through Jesus. So verse 22, I'm going to read 22 through 24 here. This righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference between Jew and Gentile. Here's this verse. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And all are justified freely by his grace through redemption that came by Christ Jesus. Now, this is a great verse. I told you it's probably the second most quoted verse in the whole Bible. All sin and come short of the glory of God. I got that verse quoted to me. All us sinners, you know, all us. But let me read this again to you, and I want to go in and talk about it a little bit. For verse 23, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Now, how many have sinned and fall short of the glory of God? All. Now, in the NIV here, it says and. Now, we know in sentence structure, and means the sentence is going. We've got a, what do they call them, a compound or a conjunction. Yeah. So, how many are we dealing with in the first part of this verse? All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We're dealing with all. So when he says, and, how many we're dealing with? All. See, nobody quotes the second part of this verse. Well, it's actually another verse, but nobody quotes it. And he says, and all are justified freely by his grace. Now, wait a minute. So you see, we stop at the, oh, we're all just sinning. See how pessimistic we are. We all sin and come short of the glory of God. Paul wants to make that point. Yes, we've all messed up, but at the same time, give us this hope and say, and that same all is now justified freely by his grace through redemption that came by Jesus Christ. So see, we quote half of the story. All have sinned and fell short of the glory of God. And that same all have been justified or made righteous through the redemption in Jesus Christ. I mean, that's what people always want to do. They want to pull that verse out. See, and they want to say, see, people are awful. They're totally deprived. There's nothing good in any of us. I heard it quoted a million times. In my flesh dwells no good thing. We're just horrible people. No good in any of us. Again, Paul is making that point. All of us mess up. But his larger point that Jew, Gentile, Roman, barbarian, American, Russian, Chinese, Mexican, all in the same boat needing to be rescued by God. And again, I'll say this. Yes, all have sinned, and that same all receive grace and redemption through Jesus. I always want to tell them, people, read the next verse. Don't just give me that one. Give me the next one. So we can say, yes, this is about sin, but this is not a statement about the awfulness of humanity. This is an argument about against grouping and in-grouping and out-grouping. Okay, this was Paul's argument. Our group is different than your group. We're better than you. No, we're all in the same predicament together, and Christ has come to save us all. That's Paul's point here. He loves that fish. So let me read 25 and 26 again. For all have sinned. Oh, that's 23. I'm going to go down to 25. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. Now, to help us understand, again, I wanted to use the NIV here. To help us understand what's going on in verse 25, when Paul says that Christ was presented a sacrifice of atonement, we got to go back to verse 22 when he says that the righteousness of God is given through faith in Jesus Christ. Now, remember, I told you we got to do some heavy lifting here, some thinking. Now, these are sort of hinge ideas in this passage. It brings us back to one of the big discussions we had a couple of weeks ago of the difference in the Greek language of the objective and the subjective genitive case in the Greek. And what we were talking about was faith. You remember, was it our faith or was it his faithfulness? Okay, so that was, and it plays a role in how you understand Paul's point here. And in English, we'll use prepositions in, of, and these denote relationships between parts of a sentence. In Greek, those prepositions are often replaced by the ways that nouns are formed. You add different endings that communicate the relationships instead of prepositions. It's the way the language operates. So in Greek, where it says the righteousness is given through faith in Christ Jesus to all that believe, we went over that verse, is exactly the same thing as the righteousness is given through the faithfulness of Jesus to all who believe. So see, one is relying on my faith, the other is on his faithfulness. But yet those two have to come together. I say it this way sometimes, and I mean, it's a simple thing, you know, if, you know, on one hand, let's say I invited you over for dinner, but I didn't have any dinner cooked, and then I invited you over next week to come to dinner, and I didn't have any dinner. On the third time, you're like, well, this guy ain't got no dinner ready, you know. But if I always have a table set, and you smell it, and you know all of this stuff. He's hollering, amen. Then you could trust that I would have the dinner ready. So, but it would do you no good if you don't come in and dine and partake. So yes, there is our trust of coming in, but it all begins with his faithfulness, and that's the point. And this is absolutely central to understanding where Paul is coming from here. Because for Paul, here's one of these big words, salvation is not just a transaction between you and God. In other words, where you believe the right things and then God saves you because you believe the right things. For Paul, salvation is a dynamic relationship where you come to understand that God is faithful to you. And you learn to trust in him because you believe that he is faithful. So it's this dynamics of a relationship here. Now, again, it's important here to understand that Paul is not downplaying the significance of our faith. He says right here, this verse we read, that righteousness is given to all who believe. Now, why is that important? I don't want to stay on that one point, but if you don't believe it, you won't receive it, right? So the gift is there. I mean, I've got the gift, and I want to give you the gift, the table. I'm saying come and eat, but you don't believe. So there is that part of participation here. And some believe that God has invited people to the table, then blinded them to the table, so that they can't come, but that's really not true. So belief is an incredibly important part of the equation for Paul, but Paul wants to uplift and make central here the faithfulness of Jesus, not our trust, but his faithfulness. In other words, you believing right things wouldn't matter if Jesus hadn't come and lived and died and rose again in perfect faithfulness to the story of God. That's what we have faith in. Jesus is the culmination, the completion, the fulfillment of everything that has been unfolding throughout human history. And now that Jesus has been faithful to that story, he invites us to put our faith, our trust in him. Well, even we could look at that and say, well, what's the big deal here? He's still talking about our belief. He's still talking about Jesus. Isn't all of this just a bunch of theological technicality without any meaningful distinction here? Well, again, yes and no. Both here. So let me explain a little bit. You don't have to understand Greek to experience grace and acceptance in God. But at the same time, when we subtly begin to think of our relationship to God as nothing more than a transaction where we exchange in believing the right things for love and acceptance, you know, I've heard people put it this way, faith is a currency. What do you do with currency? Currency means nothing. It's a medium of exchange. So faith is just an exchange. So I need something from God. Oh, God, I need this. Okay, here, I got enough faith. I believe, oh, here it is. Yeah, boom. If that's all your relationship is, then your relationship with God is no different than your relationship with Amazon or Walmart.com or whatever, right? It's a transaction. Oh, I need something. I got faith. I'm going to put it in the computer. Boom, boom, boom. 2 days later, I'll have it. Boom, there's faith. But really for me, and I hope for you, I want something more complex, more life-giving than a cosmic purchase here. Now, I understand this impulse to make the gospel as simple as possible. It's what everybody wants, right? Believe this and you'll be saved. Right? I mean, this is what they are. Just say the magic prayer. Believe this, you'll be saved. Oh, good. But that's not what Paul is giving us here. He's talking about something bigger. He's talking about a God who has a plan and a purpose to save the world, a God who was faithful to that purpose against all odds, a God who would come and give everything to demonstrate love to us. A God who hopes that we would see and catch it and respond to that love. A God that desires for us to come to the table. He's the one knocking on the door, right? He's not kicking the door down. He's knocking. His desire is to come in. A God who wants to wrap us in his righteousness and begin to transform us. A God who invites us to participate alongside of him as he heals and repairs and renews all things. See, that's good news. But that doesn't fit on a t-shirt. But isn't that a far more compelling story to give your life to than a cosmic exchange? That God is faithful to you and he tends to heal the world and you believe that and you're now part of this story of redemption? The thing is we don't get this picture, but you remember the kingdom of heaven is like a little seed. And I thought today, you know, what we want is the big, you know, the scenes. We want 90,000 healed at one time, 200,000 healed at one time. And it's one little seed at one time and one little individual and one person. And that's the way it operates here. See, faith is supposed to be something bigger than just what you believe on Sunday. It's supposed to be what gets you up on Monday. You're part of this story. What drives you to work and what motivates you to love and what pushes you to contribute to the common good in ways that transform the world into something that looks a little more like heaven. Christian people don't want to do that. They want to get out of here. And it's like, my God, we're here as part of the transformation team. You know, you go back, and I know this is maybe a horrible example, but, you know, in World War II, they destroyed cities. I mean, some of them, you know, in one bomb, boom, a whole city's gone. But then they send the teams in there to rebuild and to heal and all of this. And we're part of that team. Imagine the bomb that went off was called sin. And it devastated everything. So God is sending the reclamation team in. It began with Jesus. And now we're a part of this. He's mad. Daggone it. Mommy won't let me crawl around. So Paul sees your faith as this dynamic interplay between the righteousness of God and the faithfulness of Jesus and the trust that you've come to place into that story. That's way more than a transaction. That's a generative flow that you're invited into. Now, with that under our belt, we can move into this verse here that I wanted to look at, verse 25. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement. Again, what Paul's going to do here, he's going to talk about this faithfulness of Jesus, of what it entails exactly. Again, our faith is important to Paul. We receive the work of Christ when we come to trust in him, but we have to ask now, with all of that being said, what is this work of Christ and what does it mean that God presented him as a sacrifice? Now, if you'll read in many of your other translations, especially the King James, it uses a word propitiation. Maybe you've heard that word used that way, propitiation. So we got to get technical here. I think the NIV gets it right because they haven't over-translated this phrase here. A sacrifice of atonement. This word atonement is this Greek word, hilasterion. Many of the translations go with the word propitiation or expiation. Now, there's a problem with those words, both in different ways, and they add an outside perspective or a little nuance here to what Paul is saying. Now, propitiation, you can look it up in the English dictionary if you want. It means to appease. It means to pacify. It means to placate, mollify. It means to propitiate is an attempt to appease the anger of someone or of a deity through a gift. It gives us this idea that God is angry and he needs to be bought off and bribed in order to calm down. So, you know, God is, what's the ultimate bribe? Jesus. So, So this word propitiation, you can use this word now next time, you know, if you forget anniversary, Tim, you can say, oh, let me propitiate you with these flowers. The problem here is this doesn't sound like the God we see in Jesus. One that needs to be appeased, right? In fact, it sounds more like the gods of Rome and Egypt because they needed propitiation. They needed to be bought off with these gifts, right? And that's exactly where it gets complicated because of this Greek word hilasterion was also used in Greco-Roman religions to talk about the gifts that were made to gods precisely to placate them, to please them, to abide their affections. I mean, if you go all the way back in the Bible to Abraham, remember Abraham was called out of the land of the Chaldeans. What were they doing in the land of the Chaldeans? They were trying to appease their gods, their moon gods, with child sacrifice and whatever. So they were trying to appease. So now we read this in the Christian church, and we read it with the same mindset as the Chaldeans did. Now we got to buy God off. We got to bribe him. And Jesus comes and he buys God off once and for all. You know, he changed God from an angry God to a happy God. Now see, this is why these statements would be so prevalent in Scripture. You know, I'm the Lord and I change not. Because all the other gods changed. You do wrong, they get mad. Then you can bring a sacrifice and now they get happy. But God says, I change not. See, this is just in opposition to all the other gods that they knew. So Paul here, and we got this word, propitiation. So you're thinking, oh my God, our God is no different now than the Roman gods and Zeus and the Egyptian gods. If you take that approach here that Paul is writing in Greek to people who speak Greek as primarily thinking in terms of the Greek religion, then propitiation is a valid translation and God is appeased at the cross, right? I mean, this is what we would conclude. This word expiation, which is used in the RSV translation and many others, it means the means used to compensate or make amends for an offense. But here's the problem. The problem isn't that God needs to be appeased, right? The problem is that an injury or some kind of offense has happened, and that needs to be remedied. This would be the language that Isaiah would use. This would be the language that Peter would say again. You know, when I say an injury, you remember Jesus says, I come to heal the brokenhearted. With his stripes, we are healed. This is the language that we're using here. So this time, Jesus is an appeasing God. He is not appeasing God in his death. He is somehow fixing us in his life and death and resurrection, right? He's fixing us. He's not bribing God. The basic theological argument here is that the true God is not, again, like the Roman gods or the Egyptian gods. He doesn't change. He's not swayed by our inadequacies. His mood is not, nor ever has been, or will be the problem. God is always loving and gracious towards us. God is always angry and wrathful towards what hurts us. The problem is that Paul has already said, we all mess up, we all fall short, we all need rescued. So that break in relationship needs to be overcome. That break in relationship needs to be mended. That break in relationship needs to be healed. The English translation of this word expiation is a way of saying that Christ is faithful to take up that task of what? Mending the relationship, healing this on our behalf. Now we kind of get a picture of with his stripes we're healed. If this was about making God, really it should have said with his stripes God is healed. Right? I mean, shouldn't it say that? If God was the angry one and we needed to change him, then God would be the one who needed to be healed. But we know God didn't, we were the problem here. So Christ takes this up on our behalf. He absorbs the worst that humanity can do to a person. Remember, he's innocent, and yet at the same time, in all of this, he's still righteous, and even his response is graceful. Right? Jesus makes forgiveness complete, and he invites us into that experience through our trust in him. Now, see, that's much better. So, you know, that's why I like the NIV here. This phrase, a sacrifice of atonement, actually does a better job of drawing us back to the Hebrew roots of this word, hilasterion. So, yes, Paul is writing in Greek, and yes, there are Greek Gentiles there that are reading this letter in Rome. But as we have seen throughout this letter, and this is important, Paul is very comfortable addressing his Jewishness as the foundation for his trust in Jesus. And this is what scholarship on Paul in Romans in particular has really been trying to bring back into focus for the last 50 years. They call it the new perspective on Paul. It's 50 years old. But it's this. Here's this new 50-year-old perspective on Paul. Paul is critical of his Jewish contemporaries. Yes. He has embraced the story of Jesus. And yes, he is firmly committed to the welcoming of all peoples into the story of God. But he's still Jewish. And he still thinks like a Jew. And he still sees Jesus as a Jewish Messiah. And he still understands God as the creator Yahweh, who has been at work through all of human history, leading to this moment in Jesus. And in the Hebrew word, hilasterion was the word that was used for what we call the mercy seat in the Old Testament. The word atonement, hilasterion, propitiation. It was the word for mercy seat. Now, we know where this mercy seat was. It was overlaid with the ark. You know, I kind of want to use this language, and I don't. It's a kind of a spread out picture. When I say it was the place where the sacrifice was made, we know that took place at the altar. But it was covered in blood. It was gold, but it was covered in blood. The mercy seat. Always covered in blood. Blood on the mercy seat. So if you're talking biblically, if you're thinking in Hebrew categories, then hilasterion is primarily a geographic term referring to where something happened, not a theological term describing how it happened. Now, remember, where, not so much how. That's why I think the NIV is on the right track here, because when they simply go with a sacrifice of atonement, that's Christianity, that's Christian theology at its most unadorned beauty. This word atonement, it's a word I told you a while back, well, it was first used, maybe I got the guy's name wrong, by William Tyndale. In the 1500s, he could not find an English word to describe what was happening in passages like this or in the Day of Atonement in Leviticus. He could not find a word to go there. And the only way he could even come close, he had to add something to it. So what he did was take an old English word named atonin, which meant to be at one, and he turned it into a noun, and the noun is atonement. So what we're saying is this: in Christ, you are made at one with God. That's what atonement means. That's the good news. So God's anger is not the problem to be overcome in Romans. God doesn't need propitiation. His anger isn't the problem. The problem is sin, this broken relationship. And Paul's point here is that the location of salvation has moved from the temple, from the ritual, from all of that to Jesus. That's the point that we would, you know, love to get out to everybody who's talking about salvation, saved, and all this other stuff. It's the person of Jesus. This is where you and I are made at one with God. This is where we are healed. This is where we are redeemed. This is where we are saved. This is, he's it. He's the place. What he is saying is that the mercy seat, that place where you used to take all of your guilt and all of your shame and make your sacrifice and try to repair the relation, your relationship with God, or if you was a Gentile or a Roman who was familiar with this ideal of propitiation, of trying to bribe the gods to appease them in an attempt to buy their love and bypass their anger, Paul says all of that has been replaced in Jesus with the God who has come to find us. The God who doesn't ask for sacrifices, sacrifices and offerings thou wouldest not, but who becomes the very sacrifice. A God who doesn't ask for appeasement, but who comes to restore a relationship with us. The God who takes all of the requirements of the religious systems into himself and says, it's all done with. You don't need this anymore. Because I've come to you so that you can come to me to sit and eat and talk and rest and know that you'll never need to buy your place in my presence again. And Paul says in verse 25 here, God presented Christ as sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness. Because in his forbearance, he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. Paul is saying God did this to demonstrate his righteousness because in his forbearance, knowing that this is where the story was always meant to go, he left those sins committed beforehand unpunished. We just read all that. Paul's point here is that with God, justice is about more than punishment. It's about restoration of a relationship. That's what justice is. Because injustice means the relationship is broke. So he comes to bring justice. So in our minds, justice is always about punishment. Oh, it's about restoration. Atonement is about more than appeasements. It's about being made one with God. It's the restoration of all things through the faithfulness of Jesus and the invitation for us to come and join him and to trust in him. So as we close out, if you've ever felt like you needed to appease God's anger or buy his affection, and I have felt those ways before, if you've ever felt like the place of at-one-ment was very far off, then please hear again what Paul is reminding us of in Romans 3, reminding us that Christ has already drawn near to us. And because God and his anger were never the problem to be overcome with anyway, and that you and I, all of us, were never truly an obstacle for God who loves us deeply. It was never an obstacle. It was never a problem. And with joy, the Hebrew says, the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness. So I hope, as we go and we look these Romans again, these are some heavy passages right here that we have seen just in the quick overlook again of this book, that Paul is bringing the high-mindedness of the Greeks down. He's bringing down the mindset of the Jews who thought they were better than everybody else. And he is saying, yes, we have all sinned, but God has come and rescued us all. And he's did that in the person of Jesus. And he did this to demonstrate his righteousness, his faithfulness. And we can trust in that. Yes, we've all messed up, but we can rest and say, well, even in that, God is faithful, and he's come to rescue us. And now, as we read this letter, he has invited us to join in the restoration of all things. It's a pretty amazing story to me. Pretty amazing story. A whole lot more than just work 40 years and retire and sit on the couch. Right? I mean, it's huge. So, anyway, I'll quit with that.